Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Startup Sales. We've got a great episode today. We've got Joe Sidon with us, founder and CEO of Zero Gravity, where they work with lower income families and help pair them with jobs with larger corporations. So it's going to be really interesting to hear why that's important and the successes from that. And hopefully that's something that we could learn from as well. So let's get to today's episode.
Welcome to the Startup Sales Podcast, where we dive into the world of sales and marketing. Join us as we interview founders and industry experts, uncovering their successes and failures in the market. Get valuable insights and learn from their experiences to boost your own sales strategies. And now, a word from this episode's sponsor. Are you tired of struggling to reach your sales targets? We believe in you get what you pay for. That's why you pay only for the leads you get. Introducing Startup Sales, the leading growth hacking agency that guarantees meetings with your prospects. With our proven strategies, we'll bring you between 15 to 30 qualified prospects every month. And here's the best part, it's risk-free. You only pay us upon success. Don't let your competitors get ahead. Let Startup Sales supercharge your sales pipeline today. Visit us at startupsales.io. Startup Sales, your ultimate growth hacking partner.
Joe, thanks for joining us.
Great to be on the podcast, Adam. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah. Can you give the listeners a little bit of background about you and how long you've been running Zero Gravity?
Sure. So I started Zero Gravity straight out of university at the age of 21. And in many ways, I started to solve my own problem, which is, you know, back in the day, I was born in a small town in West Yorkshire in the north of the UK. In a single parent background, and my mum was a speech therapist in the National Health Service in the UK, and I went to state-funded schools. I made the journey to Oxford University, you know, one of the most sort of prestigious, elite, posh universities, not just in the UK, but the world. And I saw firsthand just how large the barriers are for people like me who want to break into these elite institutions. And I reflected on my own journey and how difficult it was, but also how technology in particular had transformed every facet of my life. You know, it changed the way I communicate with my friends growing up, you know, Facebook becoming the predominant social networking app, to how you get around towns and cities with Uber, or how you get food delivered to your house or Deliveroo. And I thought, if technology can disrupt those markets, why can't we use technology to identify talent from all backgrounds and create a world where talent matches opportunity? And that's what I wanted Zero Gravity to be and why I founded the business.
So what's the difference? Like, why not just use LinkedIn?
I think LinkedIn's a great networking tool, but I think LinkedIn, if you're an 18-year-old, for a start, not many 18-year-olds actually know LinkedIn exists. LinkedIn's an app you get on when you actually have a job, but most 16 to 18-year-olds are more concerned about what's going on at school than what's going on in their professional network, because they don't actually have one yet. And I think the first challenge is, now how do you identify and inspire the people from low opportunity backgrounds who should be breaking into these elite universities, but currently it's not on their radar whatsoever? Now, LinkedIn can't help you do that. But we've built technology that connects directly into the school system in the UK, which algorithmically identifies these people and connects them with our platform when they're still at school. So it takes away that kind of look of needing to discover an app. Now, you get talent spotted yourself. And then LinkedIn can be great for connecting with people, but there's no guarantee that the people you connect with there are going to help you. And they may send some messages back to you or agree to jump on one video call, but you don't necessarily get that long-term, consistent, well-structured support. So what we've built on our platform is a way to connect with a mentor who's one step ahead of you on the journey and have weekly one-to-one video calls with them. They become part of a community of other ambitious students like you. And we host regular masterclass content delivered by experts in the field to help students break into top universities and careers. And we use a lot of AI as well to help structure people's journey, give them personalized goals, the personalized plans for what to talk about in the mentoring session, and help them put together CVs, cover letters, personal statements. So it's a kind of all-in-one platform to help top talent from low opportunity backgrounds break into top universities and careers. And whilst there are platforms out there that can sort of augment and accelerate that, LinkedIn being one of them, I don't think they can do the full suite of stuff that you need to actually break into these organizations.
Yeah, LinkedIn Learning is great, but it's kind of, you know, like high level for the masses education, whereas it sounds like you guys are doing one-on-one coaching or like with a mentorship or like small classes. That's good, more personalized. So why is this important for a company, from the company perspective, to go this route of and working with you?
I think 10 years ago, people looked at this issue as purely a kind of social issue. Now, a lot of big employers would have corporate social responsibility departments where they, you know, try and make sure that, you know, talent from everywhere can succeed, or certainly talent within the communities that they operate. But I think the game's changed over the past couple of years, which is a lot of organizations now see this as a commercial imperative rather than just a social one. And there's two key reasons for that. One reason is that customers, clients, and stakeholders in general of businesses really care about this issue. Though Generation Z in particular are very conscious about social issues, with one of the preeminent ones being educational equality and equality in the workplace, because those are two issues which every young person faces directly. So I don't think businesses can afford to be in a world anymore where they don't represent the population at large, or certainly their customer base, because that's going to create a really negative sentiment with their key stakeholders. And I think the second reason is actually about productivity and performance. Now, we're going through a really difficult time in the world economy. They've got high interest rates, now inflation spiking across the world, low levels of economic growth, particularly in Europe. Corporates can no longer be in a kind of situation where they're a boat in a rising tide. Everyone has to fight now for market share to get competitive advantage over other organizations. And the key way you do that as a big organization is through talent, having the best talent on the market and utilizing it in the best way. And the truth is, most organizations currently are only tapping into a very small talent pool, a talent pool of people from a small subset of backgrounds, a small subset of schools, a small subset of colleges. They're missing most of the talent which is actually out there in the countries they operate in. And that's really bad for productivity. And a lot of the businesses that we work with, they've done these analyses on their workforces and actually found their most productive, high-performance employees are the ones who originally came from low-opportunity backgrounds. And the reasons for that are pretty intuitive. If you come from a low-opportunity background and you do break into these elite organizations, you're likely to have a lot of raw talent. You're likely to have a lot of resilience and grit and determination because you've had to overcome almost insurmountable odds. So businesses are recruiting these people, not just because it's the right thing to do and not just because their stakeholders are demanding it, but because it's ultimately good for performance as well. And that matters incredibly, an incredible amount in the current tough macroeconomic climate that all businesses are operating in.
What's been the success rate for this?
Sure. So since launch, we've mentored over 8,000 students from low opportunity backgrounds into top universities in the UK. Even just looking at Oxbridge, over two sort of internationally acclaimed elite universities in the UK, we've supported over 800 students from low opportunity backgrounds into those universities now. Roughly one in four of all of the low opportunity students starting at Oxbridge are coming through our platform. And we've driven a real change in the demographics of those universities. Now, when I was at Oxford, it was roughly sort of 50-50 when it came to people who were state educated versus privately educated. Nowadays, it's moving towards 70-30. That's a really big demographic shift in quite a small period of time. And this trend, I think, is now coming to universities and colleges all over the world. Now, in the US, there was the big Supreme Court case a couple of months ago about affirmative action in US colleges and that being sort of struck down. And I think US colleges now, as a reaction to that, are thinking far more about the background people have come from, and rather than trying to focus on like crude metrics like gender and race, actually look at the kind of educational inequalities that people have had to overcome and make sure you're recruiting talent from all backgrounds. And one of my big predictions for the US market would be, I think these sort of legacy college admissions programs are gonna go away. I don't think they're gonna be there in 10 years time, because the tide is now starting to move against them, because people clearly see they're not a vehicle for meritocracy. They're a vehicle for continuing to entrench wealth across generations.
Gotcha. So This is really interesting, and I could do a whole podcast just on this, but I don't think it aligns very much with, going to market. So let's make a small pivot. I think it's really cool. But what I'd like to kind of touch on now is what have been your learnings and experience in bringing this to the big companies and trying to sell them on this concept?
It's a really good question, Adam, because when it came to actually generating revenue for Zero Gravity, I kind of faced two problems, one of which is I never actually had a job before, let alone a job in sales. I never had a job before, so I was having to learn all of those skills from scratch. And the second thing is we're in a very new market. It's this market around businesses wanting to recruit talent from low opportunity backgrounds. This is something people only really cared about for the past 5 years. So there isn't a kind of pre-established playbook of how to sell this product into organization. And that was a challenge as well as an opportunity, because we had an opportunity to do things our own way and sort of try and become the first mover in the market. One of the first lessons I learned as a young founder, and being very naive when it came to sales, is this will be very obvious to you, Adam, but it wasn't obvious to me at the time, is that I used to treat fundraising and sales in exactly the same way. So when I came to sort of pitching to investors, I'd talk about how disruptive Zero Gravity was. This is how it creates huge amounts of value. And when I tried to do that same kind of pitch to employers, they were kind of, they thought it was a really cool idea, but in terms of actually getting the sale over the line, it was really, really difficult. And that's where I kind of learned very quickly that when it comes to selling into organizations, the qualification is so important, and understanding who controls budgets, what their interests are, how they're measured, is far more important than having the sexiest, most refined pitch possible. It's better to have a highly qualified pitch than it is to have a highly sexy, refined pitch. So that was a big learning for me as a sort of naive founder coming into sales for the first time. And I think one of the other learnings was that you have to do sales yourself when you're starting a startup, because when you're trying to build a product for the first time and get your first clients, you need to be on the front line getting those insights from the B2B clients about the way they think about your business and what their key metrics and what are those key obstacles to overcome. If you delegate that to a sales team too early, you're going to miss those insights as a founder, and that could be the death knell of your business, because if you don't start generating revenue eventually as a B2B business, you're not going to be able to raise future investment. So that I had to become a kind of one person sales force for the first couple of years of Zero Gravity's growth, and I had to sort of learn those skills from scratch. And I still remember today the landing our very first client. I think back when I was 23 years old, and we signed HSBC, which is the biggest bank in the UK and a huge global bank as well. And I almost landed them by accident. I kind of did all the wrong things, didn't pitch in the right way, didn't properly qualify, probably wasn't speaking to the right people, but I got lucky. And then from that, I was able to use that as a learning experience and stepping stone to then accelerating things over the next couple of years.
So there's two things that what you've said that I want to dive into. One is, what does qualification actually mean in your own words? And also, what mistakes you make with HSBC and that you learned from?
Yeah, I think qualification means two things. I think one's about making sure you're speaking to the right people. And then the second thing is about understanding properly what they want. And making sure you're speaking to the right people, I think, is particularly important in a startup environment, because you've got such a huge resource constraint. Now, back when I was just a one-person sales force, for instance, I couldn't spend my time speaking to everyone. And you can go down a lot of rabbit holes, especially when you've got a cool product in a kind of tackling a big social problem. Everyone wants to speak to you in organizations, but you've got to become really focused with how you spend your time. So I think one of the key bits of qualification, which especially affects small businesses, is you've got to make sure you're speaking to the right person as quickly as possible. You can burn a lot of time speaking to people who actually aren't going to be able to facilitate you getting that deal over the line. So I think that's really important. And then the second thing is actually qualifying the need of the person you're speaking to, who ultimately is the decision maker or is the budget holder or reports into them. And again, I didn't really know how to do that when I first started up Zero Gravity, but I think there's just a couple of very clear formulas you can do to sort of extract that information, right? Learn about what problems that person's currently facing in their job role, and what are the metrics that define success in their business? Now, have they used competitors before? What was their experience like? And how did they evaluate them as a good or bad partner? And I think one of the things I also had to learn as well is how to balance that qualification-driven approach with not losing the personal touch, because sales is very personal as well, especially when you're a startup. People are putting a huge degree of trust in you as an organization because you're not proven, you don't necessarily have the markers of credibility and stability yet. So it's a very trust-based sell. So at the same time you're qualifying a deal, you also have to establish a huge degree of rapport with the person you're selling to. And that's super important in a startup environment. And getting that balance right, I think, is incredibly important, but quite difficult to do.
So how do you do that? How
have I think by starting with rapport. If you start trying to qualify someone straight away, it comes across as pretty inauthentic, and people can detect that. So you want to create a real authentic relationship with someone first, and then just naturally they'll qualify them by learning more about what goes on in their day-to-day job role and what they want to achieve over the next 12 to 24 months, if that's what your product's trying to do. I think create the report, then qualify. If you're one of those salespeople who just has your kind of qualification sheet in front of you and you go for it in a very formulaic manner, you're going to really struggle in a startup sale environment because people will know they're being qualified or feel very robotic. That's not somebody you want to trust, because people don't trust algorithmic formulas. People trust human beings. So it has to be a very human-based sale. When you're a big, more established company with a brand you can lean on, you've got those assets in the background, those credibility-building assets, then you can maybe do a more aggressive formulaic sale. When you're starting up, you can't afford to do that.
So as you said before, you've got to dedicate your time and split your time properly. And you're saying don't jump right into qualification, but spend time on rapport. That's a very fine line, because rapport can take 1 or 2 minutes to build, but it could also take days. So where do you draw that line, and how do you build rapport quickly?
I think the best way to build rapport is curiosity, which is if you're genuinely curious about the person you're speaking to and what goes on in their day-to-day and what dictates success in their career, you can build authentic rapport very easily. Because you think about rapport in a friendship environment, that you have rapport based on usually a common set of interests or a common set of experiences that you've been through. So building rapport is not about having awful small talk where you chat about the weather or you chat about someone's kids or what they did at the weekend. It's about being genuinely curious about what they do at their business and asking right questions and then offering your own thoughts on what they're doing. Almost like thought leadership. It's like, okay, that's really interesting you say that. This is something I've been thinking about recently. I read this study or I saw this in my own business. That is a very authentic way to build rapport. So again, rapport building cannot be artificial. It's so easily detected. You have to be a genuinely curious person, which is curious about your industry, curious about the product you're selling and the people you're selling to. If you can't get that right, it's impossible to build rapport, and certainly not through small talk.
So I couldn't agree with you more, and it feels like you've probably listened to me a lot before, because this is exactly what I preach. But at the same time, you're kind of contradicting yourself. Excuse me. Because before you said you don't want to jump into qualification right away, but at the same time you're saying building rapport comes from asking them good questions about them and their work and their day-to-day, which is qualification.
Yeah, I think I don't think there's necessarily has to be a kind of binary divide between those two things. What I'm advising against is a very formulaic qualification-based call. To build rapport, you almost want to have maybe 30-40% up front of a call, especially a first or second call, where you're speaking about things in the industry affecting the person, affecting their job role, but you're not doing that to kind of directly qualify them and fill out a qualification sheet. You're just doing that to demonstrate and show curiosity. And you might get qualificatory insights out of it, but that's not the reason you're doing it. So I agree. It doesn't have to be a binary distinction. Like, you can build rapport and qualify at the same time. But the key is to do it in an authentic way and not come across as formulaic.
Before we jump into the second part of what I was asking about HSBC, how many sales or the first qualification calls have you had before you really started to get into a flow and understand this?
Probably 50 or 60, to be honest, in terms of, you know, speaking to people. It's very rare you get a product which lands straight away. And if you do, it's usually out of pure luck. But you've got to invest a lot of time up front to build an incredible product and build an incredible way to sell that product. And I think this is one of the lessons I also learned as a young founder, because I was such a perfectionist. I'd been used to kind of, you know, smashing my exams, you know, going to university, you know, getting a degree, founding a startup, raising money. Everything I'd done previously had been based on trying to avoid rejection and get results straight away. And I realized quickly with actually sales that rejection is part and parcel of what you're doing. And it's actually very difficult to be a great salesperson if you're a perfectionist, because you've got to be someone who doesn't like defeat, and you're willing to kind of, you know, put your all into getting a deal over the line. But you can't be someone who emotionally, you know, disconnects, you know, when someone says no to you, because if you're selling a product in a startup, you're going to hear no quite a lot. And actually, you get more insights off and out of the no's when you do the yeses. Now, we landed our first couple of clients, I think, just due to pure luck in many ways. And we probably got far more insights out of being rejected than we did from the people who accepted our product in the early days. So you're being willing to kind of, you know, get out there, speak to people and be vulnerable and open yourself up to rejection, I think, is incredibly important. And that's an insight salespeople know. But I think a lot of founders who have to become salespeople to get the business off the ground don't understand that. And it's certainly not something I understood when I started the business.
I think there's a couple key things here for the audience to take note of. Is one is all what you've been talking about to get the success is not about convincing anybody of your features and things like that. It's about understanding them, understanding their workflow, understanding their problems. So I think that's really key. And two is a lot of clients that come to me, they always say, okay, I'm going to start with the smaller clients because they're going to be easy. I can't get the big ones. They're not going to go with this early stage startup. And you just proved them wrong by getting, you know, a major bank. You know, banking is a harder industry to get into, and you're getting one of the major banks right away. So these big major Fortune 100 companies will go with startups if they trust you. And how do you build that trust? You have to exchange, you know, like, be there for them and ask them these proper questions, good questions. That's what builds that rapport, like you were saying. So thank you, John.
And sometimes in organizations, you know, you do come across these people who have a higher level of risk tolerance than the average person, you know, working at a Fortune 500 company. And those people are the people you can sell to in a startup environment. And they do exist, but you have to find them. And yeah. You know, that can be tricky. And, you know, with HSBC, you know, we worked with their global head of talent, who happened to be someone from a very similar background to myself. So he was emotionally connected to this issue. He was a very innovative person who wanted to try new things. And that's why they were ultimately willing to take a risk and a bet on a startup when a lot of other corporates wouldn't, because their risk tolerance wasn't at that level. So sometimes it can be about getting lucky and finding the right people. But then you learn over time that what does your ICP actually look like. And now we try and find those kind of innovators and thought leaders in organizations who are willing to try and do recruitment in a slightly different way. And I didn't know anything about ICP creation when I started this, and I had to learn. And I think one of the takeaways from that is, if you do come into a startup business and you're a salesperson, do not assume that your founder or CEO knows how to sell the product, because a lot of founders are like me, who don't come from a sales background. And we naturally assume that sales is like fundraising, because that's what we've done. And that's how we've experienced the business getting to the next stage. So do not assume your founder is necessarily the best person to sell the product. Actually, there's quite a lot of upskilling and learning a lot of them need to do to be able to understand how a proper sales machine works.
You've become a sales pro now.
I wouldn't say a pro. I'd say I'm still a pretty basic salesperson, but I came into this incredibly naive, and now I'm slightly less wet behind the ears.
Good. So what did you learn? What mistakes did you learn from with HSBC?
I think one of the things we didn't think about at all in the early days was onboarding, which is, I think a lot of startups, they obsess so much about getting sales because you need that as no proof of traction in order to grow. You don't actually think about how important the onboarding experience is, both as part of the sell, but also making sure you create the results that allow you to, you know, retain and increase the value of that contract. So, you know, we put a lot of effort in to actually completely revamping our onboarding process, because especially working with big B2B organizations, there's a lot of compliance, there's a lot of different stakeholders. If you don't get your onboarding right, it can mess everything up. And, you know, what we found that, you know, with some of our first clients we worked with, they were highly regulated organizations with really complex cyber technology systems. And, you know, we didn't think in advance about how to onboard people properly to integrate those processes with ours. And it made it very difficult to get stuff off the ground at the beginning. So now we actually start the onboarding as part of the sales process. We demonstrate to people as part of the sale that we know what we're doing. We're transparent to them in terms of this is what the onboarding process will look like. And that helps as part of the sale because they see that actually we've anticipated some of the problems that we're going to have. We're being transparent up front about the kind of time requirements to set up something. So actually building your onboarding process into your selling process is incredibly important. You shouldn't just like create a kind of Chinese wall between the two.
When do you bring that up in the sales process?
I think when you get to sort of some of the final meetings where you're giving someone a proper formal proposal about exactly how something's going to work, that formal proposal should encompass the onboarding process, which is a bit like you said earlier, the way you should sell a product is by selling outcomes rather than features. But I think in order to actually deliver those outcomes, you need to give people a sense of actually, you know, what does the first 30 days look like, the first 60 days, the first 90 days to get to those outcomes. And I think especially B2B clients in big enterprise organizations, they really appreciate that because a big part of their job is risk management, is compliance, is stakeholder management. And that's where onboarding really, really is powerful. Whilst if you're selling to like a small B2B client or a startup, they're going to care less about onboarding because they're not going to have complex systems to integrate with. They've got a smaller number of stakeholders. They've got a higher risk tolerance for things going wrong. So they care less. But for enterprise clients, onboarding is absolutely fundamental to the sell, let alone the success of the contract.
Joe, thanks for coming on and sharing this. I think it's been very insightful. How could people reach out to you and learn more about Zero Gravity?
Sure. So our website is zerogravity.co.uk. We are doing a small pilot in the US this year, getting low-income students in the UK into top US colleges. So that might be something that interesting to your audience. And you can follow us on LinkedIn at Zero Gravity.
Perfect, Joe. Thanks a bunch.
Cheers. Thanks for having me on, Adam.
Thanks for listening to Startup Sales with Adam Springer. Subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. Contact Adam about speaking engagements or consulting services at adam@startupsales.io.